Hello, and welcome to Sentencing Practice Talk, a podcast for federal sentencing practitioners. My name is John Scapini, and I'm with the United States Sentencing Commission. You're listening to a special mini-series on guideline amendments effective on November 1st, 2024, and appear in the 2024 Guidelines Manual. In this episode, my colleagues Lori Baker and Ross Thomas cover the amendment relating to circuit conflicts. Other policy areas in this series include acquitted conduct, loss calculations, youthful individuals, and miscellaneous and technical amendments. You can listen to all of the episodes in this series on iTunes and Spotify or on our website. Here's Lori and Ross.
All right, so continuing our conversation about the guideline amendments that are taking effect on November 1st of 2024, the next thing that we're going to talk about is circuit conflicts. And before we get into the two circuit conflicts that the commission chose to address this year, Ross, can you tell us a little bit about why the commission looks at circuit conflicts?
Yeah, so just briefly, what is a circuit conflict? It's when two circuit courts or appellate courts come to different conclusions about a legal issue. And this can happen when they're interpreting the meaning of guidelines. And so the commission, because we are constantly updating and looking at various things, has the ability to just solve circuit conflicts by addressing them with amendments. And that's something the Supreme Court has even noted. They will generally deny cert. They won't take up a case at the Supreme Court if it has to do with a guideline issue. And the reason they won't do so is because the commission has the ability, indeed sort of the duty, some may say, to resolve these conflicts to make sure everyone is being sentenced the same way.
So there's probably a fair number of circuit conflicts going on at any given time. Is that safe to say? There are circuits that look at things differently?
Yeah, as long as we've got humans making judgments about what language means, there will continue to be disagreements among, you know, perfectly intelligent and reasonable people.
So the commission can't take up all of these circuit conflicts or splits that are going on in any given time. How does the commission make a decision about which ones to take up?
Oh, that's above my pay grade, Lori, to be honest.
But it probably goes back to that public comment and the information that we receive and the things that are, you know, really being looked at.
No, exactly. As you were talking about, I think something that's really important to the commission is how often is this circuit conflict occurring? So they're always looking at, okay, who is being sentenced under this and how are they being sentenced differently? So really high numbers of individuals could be a factor that the commission looks at. How easily they could resolve the circuit conflict with language. Sometimes articulating a standard can be really hard in coming up with language. So I think that's probably another factor that the commission looks at. But generally, it's up to the commissioners to make that after listening to public comment, looking at the data, figuring out what we can do to resolve these discrepancies. But yeah, I don't make those decisions. But if you do, you let me know.
But that makes sense. Makes sense, the factors that would be considered. So there are two that are being taken up this year. Why don't you tell us about what we have to look forward to?
Yeah, this is really split up into Part A and Part B. And both of them are related to firearms. So I'll start with Part A, and this is an amendment to 2K2.1, which is really our primary firearms guideline. And in that firearms guideline, there is an enhancement, or what we call a specific offense characteristic, where someone gets four additional offense levels if he or she has a firearm with an obliterated or altered serial number. So the circuit conflict has to do with the meaning of altered. There are two circuits, the second and sixth, that took the view that for a serial number to be altered, you wouldn't be able to recognize the original information using your sort of plain eyesight. Some circuits took the view that an altered serial number occurred whenever that original information was less legible or more difficult. So even if you could make out what that serial number is just using your plain eyesight, if it was obstructed or made more difficult by any reason, then it would be deemed altered.
So two different tests. Sounds like you're saying that one was looked at more harshly than the other. I'm not sure what word to use, but one is give me a word.
No, but I think you're right. Like, one is applied more easily.
There you go.
And yeah. One is slightly more difficult to apply. And that plain eye test, right, is more difficult to get that 4-level enhancement than this less legible version.
So again, we're talking about guidelines being applied differently in different parts of the country based on how the circuit has interpreted the meaning of the word altered. So again, another disparity that the commission wanted to take a look at.
Exactly. And how they address this is that they decided to adopt the one that is maybe less harsh or more difficult to apply, and that's the plain eye test. So in order to have an altered or obliterated serial number, right, applying, right, or looking someone's ordinary eyesight, the original information would be rendered, right, like illegible, or you wouldn't be able to recognize what it is.
So you're talking about just looking at it regularly, not using like a magnifying glass or inspecting it more closely. Just can you see it when you're looking at that serial number?
Bingo.
Okay. All right. So what's the second one that the commission chose to take up this year?
So the second one, a little more tricky to explain, but it has to do with our grouping rules. So, and Lori is really the master of grouping.
Oh, that's so not true.
It is so true. But in Chapter 3, right, if someone has multiple counts of conviction, we need to figure out how to determine, right, a single offense level. So sometimes we group offenses together where someone doesn't get additional offense levels just because they have multiple counts. And sometimes, right, when these counts are totally unrelated, someone could get more offense levels based on having multiple counts. And what this circuit conflict has to do with is, do we add those more offense levels or do we group them together and no additional offense levels are added? So ordinarily, when we have a drug trafficking and a firearms conviction, if these two things are relevant to one another, you're probably going to get enhancements. So when you're calculating out the drugs, you get an enhancement for the firearm. When you're calculating out the firearms, you're going to get an enhancement for the drugs. And because you get those enhancements in Chapter 2, we're going to say those offenses group together. We do not assign units. We don't assign even more offense levels. What the trick was is that when someone had a 924C conviction, right, possession, use, discharge of a firearm in connection with, right, a drug crime or a violent crime, this mandatory minimum consecutive, what the guidelines say is those enhancements or SOCs in the drug guideline and the firearms guidelines don't apply. So the circuits got split about, do we continue to group these or do we start assigning units? One circuit, the 7th, said, hey, we're going to assign units. The rest of the circuits said, no, even though we're not applying those SOCs, we will continue to group them. So that's the circuit conflict in a nutshell. Did I summarize it right?
You did, but just so that I can get it clear in my head, this pertains to one very specific situation where someone is convicted of a drug offense, a firearm offense, and then has a 924C conviction on top of it. And it's really that 924C conviction and how it impacts those grouping rules, and the Seventh Circuit had interpreted this differently than the other circuits. So again, resulting in disparity based on where you were getting sentenced.
Exactly. So you were sentenced more harshly in the Seventh Circuit than you would be in any other circuits. So they took this up, and the rule that they adopted was the rule of the majority. And what they held was that no matter where you are in the country, if you have a 924C, drugs, and guns, you will group those offenses together, even though those SOCs are not applying.
So you group together the drug offense and the gun offense together, and then, of course, that 924C count just sits out there on its own because it has the mandatory consecutive sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. And 2K2.4, as you well know, the Chapter 3 doesn't apply to it. So that sits out and hangs out on its own. What we're concerned with is the grouping of the drugs in the firearm.
Okay, so another one where kind of leveling the playing field because there was that disparity out there. Now everyone should be applying those grouping rules in the same way.
Yeah, I think the word of the day is eliminating unwarranted.
There you go. It seems to be a common theme. All right, thanks, Ross.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Sentencing Practice Talk. You can listen to each part of this mini-series on iTunes and Spotify, as well as our website. Please be advised that the information provided by Commission staff is offered to assist in understanding and applying the sentencing guidelines. The information does not necessarily represent the official position of the Commission, should not be considered definitive, and is not binding upon the Commission, court, or the parties in any case. This episode was produced and published at taxpayer expense. That's all for now. Thanks for listening.